everyone. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Spillers After Show podcast. I am one host, Brian Dunn.
I'm your other host, Robert Hookman Jr.
And what we do here at the Spillers After Show podcast is discuss and dissect what happened at the most recent Spillers.
Spillers being the premier short fiction storytelling event held in beautiful downtown Phoenix at the Crescent Ballroom and the lounge in the front.
Absolutely. And we had our most recent one just this past November on the 2nd. And what's very exciting is, Robert, you were telling me just earlier today, we are booked for the 3rd.
Yes, Spillers number 3 was officially booked for February 1st. We'll have 6 more amazing writers for you. In the meantime, we're going to be talking to the 6th that appeared in November.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a very talented lineup, and what we do here on the after show is we want to talk about the stories behind the stories, the people behind the stories, if you know where I'm going. And one of those people who told a great story, it was an excerpt from his novel, is Ed Kearns. So, Ed, welcome. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Kick-ass event, gentlemen.
Oh, thanks so much. How did you... Well, first of all, why are you here? Is your wife not... Is your wife not about to give birth at any moment?
She
and yet
is.
You find
it's an awfully profound question.
And you find yourself
well,
with us.
She knows that, and part of what the book itself is about is the father that we kind of play to our words and to our work as writers.
Okay.
And so she very much appreciates the fact that I am also rearing this baby along with our babies. But that said, if we were going into labor, which is imminent, I would not be here. So I may have to jet out if that happens. She's actually in the adjoining bookstore. So,
is she?
If things evolve, I'm on call.
Wait.
So your wife is next door. Pregnant wife is next door.
Yes, wait, she is.
Is she a Colin Cowherd fan? Because he's the person who's promoting his new book over at the bookstore.
She's got our almost 2-year-old wandering the child section, I believe, looking for alligators.
For alligators.
Yes.
Books on alligators or
yes.
Actual reptiles?
Either one will do. I think the reptiles would probably be preferable to Azra.
Very nice.
So, yes.
Do you have a little baby pager on you right now?
Baby pager?
Yeah.
No, I think you should just involve her opening the door, and I'd probably hear Azra screaming.
Is there a chance, somebody from Changing Hands is just going to run into the room?
I was hoping she might burst in, to be honest.
That's quite possible.
That would
I think
add
we
a dramatic
should stop
flare.
Using the word burst.
It does seem good luck, though, you know?
I think it's apropos.
It does.
Mazel tov. I don't know.
Cheers.
So, you read an excerpt from Write Me Wrong, and Robert and I, we heard you read a different excerpt than the one you read at Spillers, and you prefaced it by saying something along the lines of, it was how you imagined your writing career going horribly wrong. Is that an accurate portrayal, or how would you describe it?
It's kind of, the way I kind of premise it, it's got a metafictional kind of tone to it, in the sense that the book itself is about a kind of a vain, self-obsessed writer who can't get over his own role as a, I know, right? That's a real far reach.
Isn't that redundant?
real far reach there. But it's he can't get over himself and his own career and that parenting that we do to our work enough to be a quality parent, husband, brother or friend to anybody. So basically, it was an imagining of. I kind of called it a dark fantasy. Of my life gone wrong in every capacity, not just as a writer,
right,
but as a father, brother, husband, son.
Sure.
And so in the process of doing it, I realized it was like, and I think it's kind of the premise of the book is on the outer level, that's the inside of the story. On the outside, metafictionally speaking, if you will, it's about me writing it and the process of it being necessary for me to produce my life that way on the page so I don't live it in reality.
Might
say. Yeah.
And now, isn't one of the ironies that the protagonist in the book is a children's literature writer? Isn't that part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely a facet of it. Yeah.
It's a facet of it.
I figured, what's the most fucked up thing he can write about if he's, failing as a father? And I decided, children's literature.
Children's books,
good.
Sure. Of course.
It's also something, I've dabbled in a little children's fiction back in the day. And I think I'm going to do it again because as a fellow father, I'm sure anything for children is grossly overpriced and there's a ton of money in it.
Oh, incredibly
I've
so.
I've never, fancied myself a capitalist, but this just might be the time for me to jump on the children's lit bandwagon.
It certainly might. It's 12-page books for $14.95?
Exactly.
And you buy them willingly.
Maybe 30, 40 words?
Yeah.
Perfect.
If that. The illustrations take up 3/4 of the page.
Exactly.
30 or 40 really good rhyming words.
Yes, exactly. Well chosen.
Oh, yeah. They've got to be the right words.
Go for nonsense, you know?
Sure.
Sounds.
Gibberish cells.
They're kids. What do they know? So you recently had another excerpt from Right Me Wrong published in Four Chambers Literary Magazine.
I did, yeah. That checkout time, that piece is kind of at the end of part one of the book, I guess you'd say. Mm-hmm. When I read it, Spillers was right near the beginning, kind of the second chapter, I guess you'd say, of the book. And then checkout time occurs at the end of the first part. Yeah.
So is this a novel that's finished, completed? What are you doing with it right now?
In the novel writing process, I've realized, I don't really think that it's finished until it's maybe published, and you can finish it maybe prematurely if you put it out yourself.
Right.
If someone else tells you it's ready to go to print, like we've discussed, Robert, you know, you get a copy of it in the mail as the test copy run off the press, then maybe it's finished. But because I thought I had this thing finished. I had a manuscript of it ready when I moved to Phoenix about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
It was extremely skeletal, and it was by no means finished. Now I think I have something that's about twice the length that it was before.
Okay.
I'm working on a revision of it, and I think it's close to finished again.
Wow.
So
that's fantastic. Finished for the
we'll
second time.
We'll see how many finished it has to go through before it does actually, you know, reach completion.
How many words are we talking about here? You said you doubled the length of it?
Yeah, when I thought I had a skeletal, really would have been a novella, was about 29,000 words. Right now it's about 50,000.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah. Which is still a short novel, but
it is a short novel, but it's still well within that novel word length range.
It's about all I can get out of, you know, jerking off in a dark room about my life gone badly, you know? So, which is kind of what it's gotten to become for me, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do you think you'll know when it is finished? Finished for me is like such a subjective word. I'm not sure you can ever, I mean, because you can keep tweaking things endlessly. Or you can rip it in half, or you can double it. You can do all kinds of things to it until the day that it's actually officially out of your hand.
I guess that's really true. And I think before this, I've written a lot of short fiction. And a lot of times when I would go exhaustively review and revise my work, it was on when I could read it multiple times, a week or two or three or a month apart, and I'd be able to say to myself, oh, you know what, I'm satisfied with it. I find it to be something that I enjoy. Maybe I can even forget in the process of revision that I wrote it. That's a good sign that maybe you're at a point where it's good.
Do you ever have those moments where you'll read a line and you'll forget that you wrote the line, but you really like it, and you say,
sometimes.
Oh, wow. That's
sometimes. Usually,
that came from me.
Usually it's on those days, or, you know, which I hate to admit, but every writer has them, you know, days where you're just like, oh, I don't know if I can do this, man. And then you look back over your old work and like, where did it go? Yeah. Where did it go, man? Where did it go?
Right.
So, yeah, no, I do sometimes hit those lines where it's just like, this is the good stuff. You know, it's a funny place for me right now as a writer because I started the book about, you know, imagining fatherhood in essence and this sort of thing long before I became a father.
Wow.
About a year and a half before. The idea became reality. Because the chapter I read at Spillers involves the writer, you know, moving cross-country trip back to Arizona where he's from, which is, you know, I grew up here, born and raised, moved to New York in 2006.
Yeah.
Spent 8 years there and then moved back here. It was always kind of part of the plan to do that. We didn't really want to raise a family in New York City.
No.
We wanted to fatten our livers there and that sort of thing, which we did an ample job of. It's not really a city for raising kids. It's a great one to be one. But at 29 through 33. But anyway, though, yeah. So, yeah, it's a strange place for me in my life because I think these major changes kind of change who you are as a writer as well.
Definitely.
And it's funny to have a project that dealt so intrinsically with fatherhood and then to now be at a point where I am a father and my writing style and content and everything has changed. And so not to say that the piece is it is kind of a time capsule for me. And I think you know, often to revise an older short story, like I was discussing with Robert recently when we sat down, it's like, I have a short story about an old timer fresh out of prison, you know, building a bomb for his son kind of thing. And to get in the mood for that, I had to listen to Nebraska, you know, and Ghost of Tom Joad, Bruce Springsteen music, like, exhaustively as the playlist. When I stepped away from it and went back to it and started reworking with the story, I kind of had to put that playlist on again and get back into the mood of the voice of this old timer. Well, with this, it's an interesting thing because it is such a skewed mirror, fractured mirror of myself. To get, it's kind of a, and it's an unhealthy version of myself. So
right.
It's kind of it's a wicked kind of process, kind of an ugly process to revise something like this. But
I think the voice for it carries really well. I mean, that's always such a tough thing to do with any sort of character, even if it is, you know, a version of yourself. It's narrowing yourself enough that you can sound one way.
Okay.
So you are three dimensional, but you have that sort of consistent verbiage and the consistent tone and the consistent sort of nuance in your language and things like that. And I think from what I've heard so far, the excerpt you read at Spillers and at the Four Chambers issue release party, that voice is very much carrying. So I think the consistency is working out.
Thank you.
It's working out really well. So you actually had a lot of other practice while you were in Brooklyn in terms of you had said that you are a very different writer now than you were then. But the whole time you were in Brooklyn, well, I don't know about the whole time, tell us about the reading event that you were hosting there.
That kind of became, as the march toward fatherhood became more evident to me, you know, I needed to, I felt the need to kind of, and the move away was on the calendar, in essence, for about a year and a half. I'm about a year and a half out, and a buddy of mine and myself, I mean, I got this book going. I began to realize I needed to put all my existing work into collections and self-publish a bunch of stuff, which I did.
Okay.
And then I began to realize that I was going to a lot of reading series, and a friend of mine I went to Brooklyn College with, Jesse Katz, and his friend Tamara, they put together this reading series called Having a Whiskey Coke with You in Freddy's Bar in South Brooklyn. And I was blessed to have been a part of a very interesting, dare I say, kind of movement or collective of writers at Brooklyn College at the time. We didn't give two shits for genre necessarily. There were excellent poets and fiction writers, and we just had a great time hanging out and writing together and drinking a lot together and doing these things in this you know, jovial, very friendly, warm, familial environment at having a Whiskey Coke with You. And that's kind of where I cut my teeth as a person reading out.
Okay.
And I started to really enjoy it. And I studied film and acting and this sort of thing as a younger man. And so, as I write, I usually write out loud, or I definitely read out loud when I revise my work.
Right.
And so, before, you know, performing it to a room became a passion of mine.
Yeah.
And I started going to other readings outside of Whiskey Coke, and I started to see that the New York literary scene, as you know, vibrant as it was, and as much as there was happening, it was very fractured. It was almost like walking into a high school cafeteria, the way the tables were divided, in essence. You know, it was almost like you had, you know, not to say there was a cool table and this kind of thing, but, you know, naturally each products of every school or of every mentor's tutelage kind of gravitate together, and they kind of ostracize to some degree, whether knowingly, willingly, you know, or accidentally, a lot of other groups and influences and voices. So I started to try to wander around these readings, and in so doing, I said, you know, well, there, you know, my buddy and I, we started kind of kicking around the idea of starting a reading series. There was a great place called Jackie's Fifth Amendment, an old drinking bar that smells like your grandparents', you know, living room after a flood, you know.
After a flood.
And if your grandfather was like a drunken Irishman. But so it was a great bar.
Which he was.
Excellent. Mine too.
So it was a whiskey.
But it was a great,
so
great
sorry,
bar,
Pop.
And we decided to go with the name The Buzzard's Banquet because another old writer friend of mine said he lived in a part of New Jersey that was a Buzzard's Banquet, and it meant like there's a bunch of old people living there. And so I decided, you know, The Buzzard's Banquet's a great name for a reading series. How can I tie it to words? I was like, oh, well, you know, written words are dead on the page. You know, when they're spoken, they come to life. So let's have a banquet for the, you know, this kind of thing. And banquet
so
also
wasn't
being
because
like,
you wanted a lot of old people at the readings?
I would love that. And that was, and actually we had at one of the first readings at Jackie's Fifth Amendment, a really cool guy I drank with at the bar there multiple times, a varicose vein in his leg burst open, and there was, like, more blood than I'd ever seen.
Good God.
All over the floor of the bar, paramedics came and all this jazz, so it was intense. I'm hoping he's okay. The bar is shut down since. I can't really follow up. But anyway, that was the Buzzard's
Banquet. And then it all came crashing down.
That is fantastic.
And we ended up putting together a hell of a good run for about a year and a half. I passed it off to Timur Mokudinov, hell of a writer out in Brooklyn. He saw it through for me, but
nice.
We had some pretty premier talent out there. I'm really happy that we were able to do. I mean, Phil Clay just won like the Book Award. We had him at one of the last ones that I was proud enough to curate, and Scott Cheshire, Helen Phillips, incredible writers that have had a great influence on me. And
right.
So yeah, when I came to Phoenix, needless to say, I was very much jonesing for some quality readings and to get into the scene. I had a vision of maybe trying to curate something, but you guys are taking care of that rather beautifully, I have to say.
We just barely beat you to it.
I thank you very much for doing so. And it's a hell of a fun job, but it's a lot of work.
When you submitted, I have to say, like, my first reaction was like, okay, so who's this guy? And I read your story and I liked it. And I popped over and figured out what your website was and looked at the website. And there's literally like an entire page just filled with videos of you doing readings.
Oh my gosh! And so many videos.
And I texted
so many
Brian
videos.
Like, so this guy has experience.
A bit of experience, yeah.
And we just like agreed, you know. Yeah, he's in.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, definitely. So,
thank you.
So this book is called Write Me Wrong that you're working on.
Yes, yeah.
And you mentioned that you started writing it and it was long before you started having children.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was about a guy who's having his first kid.
Yeah, well...
So did you write yourself wrong, or did you write your own future?
That's the dangerous thing, I think. A good friend of mine, Dorian Kula, he's an Albanian madman, and I went to one of my former classmates and writing colleagues, but he shared with me that a personal story of his own that's very stark and sad and a very much a warning for anybody who wants to write about what could be the future. He wrote about like his parents dying, and they died like very shortly thereafter. So it's like I pray to God I've not written my future.
Would be the worst possible scenario, would it not?
That's part of the it's part of the pain of the process, I think, in essence, is imagining that, you know, drawing a path that could be. So I really hope not. Yeah.
Jesus, on that note.
Be careful what you write, Robert.
I like to end with a joke. You got one?
Well, let me ask you real quick. You mentioned the self-publishing route.
Yeah.
And that you did that for a while. What was your experience with that? Would you recommend it to somebody? What did you learn from it?
You know, I mean, I was sitting on a trove of short fiction and essays and things that I'd written over my tenure in New York. All available at edkerns.com.
Edkerns.com, everybody. That's no, okay. Plugs are allowed.
But I did
that in other podcasts.
But I did. But I did. I really enjoyed with fatherhood imminent. I realized short stories, short fiction doesn't really sell outside of it. Doesn't sell. Period. But you know, you can get it published in publications and journals and this sort of thing. So I did a bit of that.
Yeah.
And that can help you to try to get a collection of short fiction published, but I needed the fast track to get these babies out into the world before my baby was born.
Right.
And so I put together what ended up being, I think, two novellas, collection of essays, and two collections of short fiction. It sounds like a lot, but some of them are very short, but they're arranged thematically.
It does sound like a lot, yeah.
They're arranged thematically. And I mean, what I enjoyed was it did it prove to be the most lucrative path for me? If no, I'm not very good at self-promotion, even though I'm very good at whispering into a microphone at kerns.com. But I'm not very good at self-promotion. And so, I mean...
Did it again.
No, I'm not very
it's
good
the
at...
the Kerns show all of a sudden.
I'm not very good at...
He's taking over. Wait, what do you mean you're not very good at self-promotion?
Well,
you kind of seem like a natural. You mentioned your performance background. You're gregarious as all hell.
You've already plugged yourself more than we've plugged Spiller.
And eminently likable.
Well, thank you, man. But no, it's... I don't know. I mean, as far as mass marketing, too much pumpkin porter, but no mass market, as far as like marketing or doing the savvy that it takes to get that kind of thing. I don't think I have that, that ilk in me very much. So I've sold, I sold a decent amount at some events I did in New York and this sort of thing. And it was a lot of fun designing the book. It's very technical. If you're a word-minded person, there's a lot of, like, to get the size cut that you want and all that. Set up your margins on Word. And then the cover art I kept very simple. So, I mean, I'd say it's a nice route to go if you really want to get your words out there and see them in print. There's nothing really more satisfying than that.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think that something more satisfying would be having someone else do it. So, I mean, I would encourage people probably to, if you're sitting on a nice, healthy manuscript and you want it put to print, query some agents, try to find somebody interested in it that wants to help you know, put it to the, put it out.
Try to go traditional.
I think it's a good. I think so. I mean, because we writers, I think what we, you know, we're writers, and that's what we should, you know, we should be in a cave alone writing and do it. And come out when we're summoned, and then get back in there and get back to writing. And
but you, my friend, you are not going to have a lot of cave time coming up. I hate to bring it to you. I know you know that's the truth. But
it is. It is. I'm hoping to finish a draft of the manuscript, shop it around, send it to a couple people that I trust out in the, and get some visions.
And there's your wife now.
Start a new book.
No.
Oh, Robert was just kidding.
Very soon. Oh, my God. Dude, the fear of God in me. Probably just lost all color in my face. But, yeah.
Interesting.
No, you guys are doing a great thing. I by no means mean to plug this writer. I think you guys are doing a beautiful thing for the Phoenix scene, and you brought together such incredible talent. And I thank you guys so much for doing it. Honestly, I mean,
absolutely,
it's a breath of fresh air in the Phoenix literary scene, I think.
Well, we started it just because we wanted to take over the literary scene. But then we realized we couldn't speak at all of the events.
The painful thing for me
when
we
should invite other people too.
The painful thing for me when I first came to Phoenix was that so many of these readings happen in coffee houses and art galleries and things.
Right.
It's a precious but a fun but a kind of a precious thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the writers that I know and appreciate the most often do it in conjunction with alcohol.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a den that we can do that while we're enjoying words as well.
Yes, yes. It is catered. Yeah. Catered for you, Ed.
It's brilliant. You
alcohol
know?
Is
and
available.
Our grandfathers. So it's,
and our grandfathers, yes, absolutely. Well, so do you think you've found your literary scene now? You mentioned it was a very robust scene back in Brooklyn, and now you're here. Do you feel like you've really kind of hit your stride in terms of that?
You know, I feel like New York's a funny place that if you're there and you're active, the city will love you, you know?
Yeah.
And but if you leave and you're not, you know, it's got a very short-term memory to some degree.
Okay.
I've maintained healthy relationships, and I know that I have some people out there that I... you know, dear friends that I'll maintain a friendship with, and that I can continue to offer whatever assistance I can offer to them, and hopefully they can, I know that they'll return the favor to me. And here, I think I'm meeting people like you guys and the Four Chambers folks.
The Four Chambers folks are great.
Jake and Kelsey,
we love them. Jake and Kelsey,
phenomenal.
Oh my God, Casey or Kelsey is right here.
Phenomenal people, and doing
they
wonderful things. So I mean, like I think. More importantly for me right now is buckling down in the craft. You know, I think I have a healthy community around me, but I need to focus a lot more on just right now finishing the novel at hand and getting the next project started and finding, you know, where I'm at as a writer with this double dose of fatherhood on my plate now and
sure
how that's changed me. And so no, I think I have a very healthy community though through which to explore these things.
Right,
and
right.
You guys are putting together killer events I can go to for, you know, contemporary inspiration, and so yeah, I thank you guys again for providing me with, you know, a place to speak and peers to meet.
Oh,
but,
my gosh, absolutely.
Well, if this podcast is about anything, it's about being self-congratulatory. So thanks for helping us out with that.
We are practically breaking our arms, patting ourselves on the back.
No, it's
I thought it was interesting that you said, so like in Brooklyn, you if you're there and you're active, they'll love you. And I think Phoenix is very much like that, too. But I think the flip side of that is that Phoenix also kind of has a good memory because the art scene, you know, is up and coming as opposed to 1,000 years old. And, you know, and it's sort of bubbling up every day in all kinds of different ways. And the people who are part of it, I think, like, the you know, it's got a little better intrinsic memory right now. So if they disappear for a minute, they're not going to forget about you. Like,
I hope not.
If Ed Kearns disappears, I mean, you now know all the, you know, the literary bigwigs in town.
It's always nice
like
to make
Kelsey.
It's always nice to make reemergences, though, I guess, too, you know, if you need to, if you in essence. But, but no, I think you're right. And I think that, you know, you have a bit more of a rooted population and rooted and growing culture here. New York is a far more transient city, you know. A lot of the people that I shared a very dear community with are all over the place at this point.
Right.
You know, really, they're all over the country now. So it's again, it's an episodic city, you know. Everybody's version of that strange, wild shithole is a completely different picture.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know, in Phoenix, the artists that are here, they stay here and they fight for years. So I'm serious.
Yeah,
they,
no,
they,
it's a good point.
It's a really tight community.
Or they leave and then come back. It's got a pretty...
Yeah, they don't leave.
Pretty strong magnetism.
Yeah. Well, we're happy that you are here, Ed Kearns.
It's great to be here, guys.
That's
and I
awesome.
Look forward to... to growing alongside you guys.
Yeah, and I wish you good luck finding some cave time. That will be your challenge, my friend.
I'm just going to forego sleep all the more.
All right.
2 hours, baby.
Borderline maniacal. I think it should be noted. Well, thanks, man. We really appreciate you being here, and thanks for being a guest on the podcast.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, man.
You guys rock.
So thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of the Spillers After Show podcast. We enjoyed having you.
To find out more about Spillers, check out our Facebook page at Spillers PHX. That's Spillers Phoenix.
And if you are inspired to submit to be part of the next Spillers event, please go to spillers.net.
And you can check out the podcast website at spillersaftershow.com.
And a special thank you to our sound guy, Steve Wiesenthal.
A special, very special thank you to Crescent Ballroom. And to Southern Rail, who's been kind enough to host our podcasting recording session.
Absolutely. All right, thanks, everybody. We will see you soon.